From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
There's a little song that we sing in our movement down in the South. I don't know if you've heard it, but it has become the theme song. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. Deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome. Though I've joined hands so often with students and others behind jail bars singing it, we shall overcome. Sometimes we've had tears in our eyes when we joined together to sing it, but we still decided to sing it. We shall overcome.
That's Martin Luther King Jr. on what may be the greatest protest song of all time, We Shall Overcome. He heard the song in Tennessee and couldn't get it out of his head. We'll find out why. This hour, Singing the Revolution, music that shaped a new world order. From the songs of the 60s to the year 1989, when music and revolution collided. Also, a writer takes us back to the Nicaraguan Revolution and the culture of the Internacionalistas. But first, if you want to talk about music and revolution, there is one voice that stands out, Bob Dylan.
He was just very, very powerful. His voice was plain. I never thought it was raspy or harsh. I thought it was plain. But he was singing of extraordinary things. I remember the first album of his I heard was Free Will and Bob Dylan, the second album. I loved the cover. I thought the cover was fantastic. But the songs on that album, particularly A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, were like, you know, nothing I'd ever heard before. And I was kind of hooked from the start.
That's historian Sean Willens. He's just written a new book called Bob Dylan in America. Now, the thing about Dylan, as any fan will tell you, is that he has had a mercurial career. The minute you think you've got a handle on what his music is all about, it changes. So how does that translate to Dylan's politics? Willens says the birth of Dylan's music is deeply wound up in the politics of the time.
The world of the folk revival had always been attached to the left, right? I mean, it came out of the left in many ways. But when Dylan came along in 61, 62, it was very deeply intertwined with the civil rights movement. And so his songs, Blown in the Wind, Oxford Town, I mean, all of that stuff was coming out of his life, his concerns of the time. And his views on, you know, sort of racial injustice in particular have always been very, very strong. I mean, they continue up to this day.
Oxford Town, Oxford Town, everybody's got their heads bowed down. Sun don't shine above the ground, ain't going down to Oxford Town.
His attraction not just to black music, but to black people, actually, black performers, has always been very strong. So it's not just a political statement, but he was very involved in politics until around the end of 1963, when I think he realized it for himself that no political movement was going to affect the kind of change that he was, singing about.
You talk about the connection between Dylan and the American composer Aaron Copland, who mined folk music for his compositions. And Dylan later on played Copland's music before his concerts. So there is a connection there between the music and the politics, too?
Very much so. I mean, he was tied up with the Popular Front, the left, in New York in the 1930s and on into the 1940s. Pete Seeger's dad reviewed one of his concerts, gave it a rave review in 1934. Pete Seeger was being dragged to hear Aaron Copland, of all people. So it came out of that same impulse, beginning in the mid-30s, to blend culture and politics in a kind of populist vein that came out in the 40s in Copland's orchestral work with things like Fanfare for the Common Man, where the title kind of tells you what it's about. And so that world, which was not that disconnected completely from Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie, the figures that we know shaped Dylan's work, it was part of a force field that Dylan inherited. Now, Dylan didn't listen to Aaron Copland and then go out and write Blown in the Wind. But nevertheless, if you want to understand that broader frame of reference, I think Copeland actually helps you understand it a lot.
And what Copeland did, incorporating folk music, it's not that different from what Dylan did with the lefty folk operas Pirate Jenny and Threepenny Opera.
Well, I'm glad you see the parallel, yeah. I mean, the interesting thing about the Threepenny Opera connection was that yet another one of these American composers who was around in the 30s, a man named Mark Blitzstein, whom the listeners might remember as the composer of a sort of left-wing folk opera called The Cradle Will Rock. It was Blitzstein's translation of the Threepenny Opera, which was playing off-Broadway in the late 1950s and then had a small revival when Dylan was in New York. It was that translation, especially of Pirate Jenny, that bowled Dylan over when he went to hear it.
By noontime, the dock is all swarming with men coming off of that ghostly freighter. They're moving in the shadows where no one can see, and they're chaining up people and bringing them to me, asking me, kill them now or later.
Listening to a singer named Mickey Grant sing Pirate Jenny, but it was Mark Blitzstein's words. You know, and so when you see what happened with how Dylan appropriated that, not so much the melody, but the words and the imagery, again, you're taken back to 1930s left-wing New York, so it all kind of connects.
Then they'll raise their hands, saying, we'll meet all your demands, but we'll shout from the bow, your days are numbered. And like Pharaoh's tribe, they'll be drowned in the tide, and like Goliath, they'll be
interesting looking at Dylan, isn't it? You've got this early period when he was in New York playing in Washington Square, playing with Dave Van Ronk and Peter Paul and Mary and hanging around with Pete Seeger. And then there is that kind of, oh, God, it's just not going to work. None of this is going to make any difference period when he remained a great artist but moved away from it. So a lot of people think of him as a poser, somebody who was just in politics because it was a way to get advanced. You don't see him at all that way.
I've heard that, and I can't imagine someone writing, I don't know, Blown in the Wind or Oxford Town. I can't imagine anybody doing all of that and doing it all cynically. There's no question that Bob Dylan was very ambitious. He has said in his memoir that, you know, destiny was staring at him and only at him, and he was going to follow. But, you know, I think that Dylan is the kind of artist who has gone through many different phases, all of them sincere, but all of them up for questioning. And he never settles in too comfortably into any one of them. He's got a very restless muse, and the muse leads him in very different directions. So I think that, you know, by the time we got to the end of 1963, after the Kennedy assassination, which I think actually had a great impact on him as it did on everyone, a great trauma, I think that he was not just dissatisfied with politics, but I think he wanted to move in a different vein artistically. He wanted to express things that he couldn't express simply talking about politics, and he wanted to do it in a language that you couldn't do within the form of conventional folk music. You could do it with a guitar and harmonicas, but you couldn't do it with that kind of language. So he moved on. But Dylan has done this throughout his career, and it's not because, you know, I mean, let's jump to the late 1970s when he starts writing his gospel music. I mean, if you were thinking of a really shrewd career move, I don't think that moving into gospel music in the late 1970s was it.
Well, especially not for Bob Dylan. You wouldn't expect him to go there at all.
That's right. But he had a genuine religious conversion. He genuinely became a Christian. And that was what, not just his muse, but that's where his soul was taking him.
You may be a preacher, spiritual pride. Maybe a city councilman taking bribes on the side. Maybe working in a barber shop, you may know how to cut hair. And maybe somebody's mistress, maybe somebody's heir. But you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, you're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
Well, it may be the devil, and it may be the Lord. But you're gonna have to serve somebody.
It brings me back to this business of Dylan sort of remaking himself and reappearing in people's lives. We talked about how passionate people have been about him and in both enjoying him and rejecting him.
Right.
And about the politics, it seems to me it's in some ways it's the same thing. You say he's political and then he isn't political and then he's political again and then he isn't political.
Right.
Well, what was the thing he tried to sing on the Ed Sullivan show?
Right. It's kind of relevant again because the John Birch Society is back in the news. He had written a song called Talkin' John Birch Blues or Talkin' John Birch Paranoid Blues, which is about the John Birch Society. There were other songs about the John Birch Society at the time, making fun of it. His was more cutting, though. And he had one line in there which seemed to liken the John Birch Society to Hitler.
Now, we all agree with Hitler's views, although he killed 6 million Jews. It don't matter too much that he was a fascist. At least you can't say he was a communist. That's the same like if you got a cold or took a shot of malaria. Well, I was looking everywhere for them gall-darn Reds. I got up in the morning, looked under my bed, looked in the sink behind the door, looked in the glove compartment of my car. I couldn't find them.
CBS took this as a, prima facie case of libel, so they didn't want to put it on the Ed Sullivan show. In fact, they pulled it off his record, too. It was going to be on Freewheeling Bob Dylan, but Columbia Records pulled it. And Dylan was greatly outraged. I mean, he just thought this was a case of censorship. So, he gave way on all of that, but he walked off the Ed Sullivan show. He refused to appear on the show at all. And, if you're of our age, you'll remember in 1963, an appearance on Ed Sullivan was a career maker.
Anybody who says that Bob Dylan was only ambition just has to take a look at that.
Precisely. Exactly. He really did believe in, the freedom of expression, quite apart from the politics of being able to say what he believed. And that was at the heart of what was going on in the folk revival.
Yeah. Thinking about Dylan and politics again, which is sort of where we started this conversation, do you see the Bob Dylan of 2010 as political or as powerful as the Dylan of 1964?
Well, it depends on what you mean by politics. He's not writing political songs. He's not writing anthems to any movement. But then again, there's no movement to write anthems for. There was the Barack Obama political campaign, which had plenty of people doing things for it. He contributed some things to it, actually. But Bob Dylan in his art has moved well beyond doing that kind of more transparent political statement. And yet, when you listen to some of the recent work, there's a measure of politics in it. On a song like Summer Days, when he talks about politicians in his running shoes, I actually thought of Bill Clinton. He's making clear his, not aversion to politicians at that point, but, his mistrust of them.
Politicians got on his jogging shoes. He must be running for office, got no time to lose. Sucking the blood out of the genius of generosity. He been rolling your eyes, you've been teasing me.
This politics laced throughout Dylan's work continues to be there. You can't have as large an imagination, I think, and be writing in such an ambitious way as Bob Dylan does without politics being there. Politics is part of the world we live in, so it's going to be part of what he's trying to talk about. It's just that it's not going to be, preaching to you, telling you, well, as he used to put it, finger-pointing songs, pointing out who the malefactors are, and then telling you to go out and do something or inspiring you to go out and do something. He's not going to do that. But that doesn't mean that politics aren't there.
Well, and the story's not over.
And the story is by no means over.
Historian and author Sean Willens is the author of Bob Dylan in America. Coming up, the mother of all protest songs. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin Online Bachelor of Science in Sustainable Management, developing leaders with the critical skills to grow a green economy. Information is at sustain.wisconsin.edu.
We shall overcome one day.
We shall overcome one day.
The power of a song "We Shall Overcome" is hard to put into words. It's been sung the world over under threat of violence. It's been sung to bring courage and hope and faith, sometimes by a single voice, sometimes by hundreds. And it became the anthem of the civil rights movement. Now, singer-songwriter Stuart Stotz has written a biography of the song. It's called "We Shall Overcome, A Song That Changed the World." He told Anne Strainchamps that it was his father who first got him interested in the history.
He took me to civil rights rallies when I was a child and was also a civil rights activist himself. And in the book, I tell the story about how he, as a young professor at McCormick Theological Seminary, went down to South Carolina, I believe it was. He didn't remember, actually, when I asked him later. And in support of a young black intern who had been arrested on the steps of the courthouse back in 1963 for singing the song "We Shall Overcome," that was declared illegal. And so they brought in people from out of town. And when he told me that story, I started to think about what other song had been so closely associated with social change. And although you can think of others, that one seemed to me to stick out, in part because it does move beyond the civil rights movement. And it wasn't just an anthem. It was a hope and courage giver, too.
It pretty much became the unofficial anthem of the civil rights movement.
That's
and
right.
Then went on and became an important song in the anti-war protests in Vietnam. It became an important song for labor movement struggles.
That's right.
It's been part of protest struggles for most of this century.
That's right. It actually began more as a labor anthem and then became part of the civil rights movement later. And then, for example, the protesters at Tiananmen Square, some of them were wearing T-shirts that said, "We shall overcome," as they faced the tanks.
Well, you did this wonderful thing in your new book. You're basically telling the biography of a song,
That's right.
Where it came from and key moments in its life. Where does this song come from in the first place?
Like any folk song, which it is in some ways, it's very difficult to pull out one moment. It's not like Lennon and McCartney sitting in a room and you can say, there, that song was born at that time. Clearly, it has roots in some of the old spiritual songs. The song "I'll Be All Right," for example, has very similar sort of structure and feeling to it. There's also a hymn by Charles Tenley, a minister around 1900, who wrote a song called "I Will Overcome." But whether that really had anything to do with the genesis of the song, no one can say for sure, because the tradition is that, in part, people create songs spontaneously and change them and adapt them to the moment and the needs of a situation. Nevertheless, there is a history that it came through the Highlander Center, which was a labor and a later civil rights sort of organizing retreat center. And Pete Seeger heard it, and it went out west, where it came through Frank Hamilton and Guy Carawan, who each added a little bit, and then it came back to the Highlander Center. And at that point, it was still not famous, but it did become this anthem that we're talking about. Then at the organizing meeting, it was 1960, but I may have that date wrong. But anyway, that was when people sort of grabbed onto it, and it took off.
Was there a moment, a kind of debut moment for the song, its first key performance?
Guy Carawan was a folk singer down at the Highlander Center, and they led a lot of retreats on the weekends for people who were involved in social change around the South. Among other people, Rosa Parks went through the Highlander Center before she did her, you know, famous action. So the people were coming through there, talking with other people about how to organize and so on. And Guy Carawan was leading the songs, lots of songs, and including this song. And then several weeks later, at this initial organizing conference, one of the people there turned to Guy and said, "Hey, Guy, play that Overcome song." And he played it, and the story is that people spontaneously stood and sang with their arms crossed, as we see in so many of the pictures. And in their words, from that day on, that was the song.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. Some
wonderful story also about the first time Martin Luther King Jr. heard it.
Right. Before, it was at an anniversary of the Highlander Center, and it was not the famous song at that point, but it was sung there. I think probably there it was sung by Pete Seeger. And on the way, as he was being driven to another engagement later on, he's sitting in the back kind of humming, saying, well, we shall overcome, something that kind of sticks with you about that, isn't there? You know, it's fascinating to me that this song would sort of bubble up.
There's a little song that we sing in our movement down in the South. I don't know if you've heard it, but it has become the theme song. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. Deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome. Though I've joined hands so often with students and others behind jail bars singing it, we shall overcome. Sometimes we've had tears in our eyes when we joined together to sing it, but we still decided to sing it. We shall overcome.
He was right, wasn't he, Martin Luther King Jr., when he
Absolutely.
Said there's something about that song that sticks with you. But you're a songwriter and a singer. What is it about that song that sticks with you, that made it the one that everybody turned to again and again?
You know, there's an element of mystery in that. If there were a simple answer, then we could write another one like it. But having said that, there is something about the tempo. Originally, it was a song kind of in two, dun, dun, dun. And Frank Hamilton apparently added sort of this dun, 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 which gives it this forward motion. It's kind of a Motown beat, actually. So that's part of it. But of course, lots of songs have that. The repetition in the song allows people to learn it very quickly. And the way that people can add to it, again, as the situation demands, I think it's also the fact that people can really get their voices around it and harmonize on it so strongly. A faster song, it's harder to harmonize on. But when you've got these long sort of held notes, and people talk about being in churches down in the South during the Civil Rights Movement and just feeling like the roof was about to take mm-hmm. off, you know, when people sang that song, that it was just so powerful to be in the center of that. And last of all, I think it's just, it's a hopeful song. For people who are facing violence, death, intimidation, hopelessness, it's a song that really says, we shall overcome.
What are the other key moments in its life? There was that first early singing at the Highland Center where it kind of took off. If you were to describe, I don't know, two or three pivotal moments in the life of the song, what would you choose?
Yes. Well, certainly it being sung at the March on Washington, you know, there where you had a huge number of people singing all together.
That's where Martin Luther King
exactly
Jr. gave the I Have a Dream speech. That's
exactly right.
And who sang it there?
Joan Baez sang it there. It may have actually been sung more than once. I'm not exactly sure, but there is a picture of her singing it. I think also that what's interesting to me is how the song was taken on by people around the world, not just the Tiananmen Square that I talked about, but how it became a number one hit in India at one point, and kind of a different language version, or how it was associated with the farm workers and how they would sing it in Spanish, different, you know, language, but still the same sentiment in a rough translation. So those kinds of things, I think, are key because the song has huge impact around the world. It's a song that in some ways may mean more to other cultures than it does to ours in terms of its immediate relevance.
Well, I associate the song largely with Pete Seeger. I'm not entirely sure why.
He did, and he had recorded the song. I believe it was when he made his Live at Carnegie Hall album is the one he was talking about. And then he went on a 9-month world tour with his family or something, you know, going to Australia and Africa and all that. And by the time he circled around to Europe, I don't know, 6 to 9 months after that album was released, he would start playing the song. And he said the concert halls would explode because people knew the song from his recording. He had passed the song that way.
And the process of working throughout the South and going to jail and getting beat and being in mass meetings and singing this one particular song that became the theme song of this movement. It is a powerful song. You can go anywhere in the world today where there is struggle, and you will find this song, and you will still see people in the streets marching and singing it. It is our gift to the world people in struggle. We want to ask you to stand up and cross your right hand over left and sing with us, We Shall Overcome.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. Lord, we shall overcome someday.
It's also probable that he changed the song from We Will Overcome to We Shall Overcome. He's a little bit uncertain himself, but he liked the openness of the shall versus will, you know. But it's not completely certain whether he's the one who did that or not.
For young people today who don't remember any of the civil rights movement protests, for whom this is all a page in their high school textbook, are there kind of, I don't know, word pictures you could paint of, you know, take yourself back, try to remember, what was it like, what would it have been like in 1963 and 1968 to be in Selma or Montgomery and hear people sing this song?
I was at the Smithsonian about 6 months ago, and I went to a little demonstration they were doing. And in this demonstration, they had people sitting at a counter, like they would have been at the lunch counter, say. And all the rest of us in the audience came and just stood all around these people without saying a word. It was a graphic demonstration of what it meant to feel intimidated and threatened. I think if you put yourself in that position and think, what will help me if I want to face people who are opposing what I'm trying to do here? Singing becomes a way to do that, to sing together. This is the heart of the story, is that singing together helps people in very difficult times. Now, do young students in elementary or even high school know that? Probably not, because they don't have the experience of that. But you really, I don't believe, would have had the civil rights movement and all of its ability to maintain a nonviolent posture, for example, without this ability to also sing together. They go hand in hand. Now, most kids have seen pictures. They've seen Eyes on the Prize documentary or other pictures, you know, the police dogs or the water hoses, things like that. They've seen that. But what's missing in a way is not just the soundtrack, but what that soundtrack did for people. It wasn't just playing in the background. It was people actively making this music that literally fed their courage, their spirits, their souls, and their hope.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday.
Stuart Stotz is a writer and performer, and the author of We Shall Overcome, a song that changed the world. And Strange Champ spoke with him. Debole and Unferth didn't set out to join a revolution, but love makes people do strange things. Back in the 80s, revolutions swept Central America. There were popular uprisings in El Salvador, Nicaragua, Guatemala, and more. Activist priests were preaching liberation theology, and Debole and Unferth's boyfriend, George, decided to join them. Before her family knew it, she had converted to Christianity, dropped out of school, and hit the road with him. In her book, Revolution, Unferth remembers what it was like to be a vocational revolutionary in the 1980s in Central America. She told Ann Strangechamps where the path took them.
We started out in Mexico and we went through Guatemala, which was also experiencing a lot of civil uprisings of various kinds. And then we went through El Salvador and we worked in an orphanage in El Salvador just for a brief time. And yeah, in El Salvador it was there was a terrible civil war going on in El Salvador. And then we went to Nicaragua, and then we stayed there for quite a long time. And then we continued on. We went through Costa Rica, where there was no war, a very strange little paradise there. And then we went to Panama, where there were a lot of uprisings against the military dictator Noriega.
And what exactly did you imagine you would do? I mean, how were you going to help these revolutionary movements?
Well, our idea was that we were going to, the primary thing that we were going to do is we were going to interview people along the way. We were going to record them, people who were involved in the various uprisings and revolutions that were going on, like politicians and priests and organizers. And what we did was we brought a bag full of our favorite music, rock tapes. You know, we were very into The Who and The Stones and Bob Dylan. And then we recorded over the music one by one with these interviews with these various priests and political people.
Now, I think there was a name for people like you in Central America, Internacionalistas?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Internacionalistas.
Which meant what?
Well, we were internationalists. You know, we consider ourselves to be part of the united world of socialists, I guess is what it would be. And so part of that was to go anywhere in the world and support socialism so that you were a citizen of socialism, not of a particular country.
So would you say there was a whole Internacionalista culture? I mean, were there chants and slogans and music you all had in common?
Oh, definitely. I mean, in every way, it was an interesting time in Nicaragua, and certainly not the least in terms of sound. All the Internacionalistas brought music from all their different countries, and this was, of course, before the internet, so none of us had really heard each other's music before, and we would all sit in these hostels and play all the different music, and just the sheer, even just listening to all the languages kind of going at once would be very exciting. There was a place that we all went to eat called Comedor Saras, and we would all sit at these tables and sing songs and speak in all of our different languages. And, you know, it was a time of tremendous celebration and pride. I mean, not only for us, but also mostly for the Nicaraguan people. And the Nicaraguan people were celebrating as well. There was a lot of salsa dancing and marimba. There was a lot of chanting, a lot of singing.
Do you remember any of the songs you used to sing?
Well, you know, I tried to remember actual songs. I mean, I did remember some of the chants. The only song that I really remember singing was the International, which was the socialist international anthem. I think it was originally written in French in something like 1871, and then it was translated into a lot of different languages, and it became the national anthem for the Soviet Union and also for the Chinese Soviet Republic.
I know I've heard it, but I can't remember the words at the moment. Do you remember how it goes, or do you remember any of the lyrics?
There were several versions in English. There was the British version, there was the American version, and then there were, in the late 80s, there were several versions that came out that were sort of like more like hippie versions, you know, that people would come up with. But the original American version went something like, 'Tis the final conflict, let each stand in his place. The international Soviet shall be the human race. That was the original American version.
So clearly there was a lot of solidarity among the Internacionalistas. On the other hand, you write that the Nicaraguan locals had a different name for you guys. They called you the Sandalistas.
They did. Well, I
referring to what? Your Birkenstock sandals?
The Birkenstock sandals, exactly.
There's a story you told, I think it was in Nicaragua, and you went to church and discovered that this local church actually had two different services, one for the locals and one for the Internacionalistas, and they sounded like they were pretty different types of services.
They were. Now, that was Uriel Molina, who was a very important priest, liberation theologian, who was a very big part of the revolution in the 70s. And then in the 80s, he had this beautiful popular church And on Sunday nights or Sunday afternoons, really, he would have these, he would have what he called La Misa Campesina, peasant mass, where he would preach about Vatican II and about liberation theology. And he would say things like, lucharemos o moriremos, we will fight or we will die. And the place was always full of internacionalistas. There were never any Nicaraguans in there except for the musicians. He always had musicians at the front playing marimba music. And so one day, George and I were there, and we were wondering why there weren't any Nicaraguans. And someone said, oh, well, they come in the morning. So we said, oh, well, can you imagine how exciting it must be in the morning when the Nicaraguans are here, you know, if it's this fun now. So we went early in the morning one week, and it was just like a regular Catholic mass. It was silent. There was just Molina saying the mass, and there was, you know, a lot of Nicaraguans in there, and they were very quiet, murmuring their prayers. And so we were sitting there just stunned. We'd been all ready for the party. And one guy said to us, you know, you should come in the afternoon. The internacionalistas come in the afternoon. And we said, well, why do you come in the morning then? And he said, because the internacionalistas are asleep. The church is not a place for dancing and making fun.
There was one story you told about an all-night prayer vigil at the orphanage. Mm-hmm. Can you describe that?
Yeah, when I first arrived at the orphanage, we had just gotten off this sort of harrowing bus ride, George and I, and they told us we were going to have an all-night prayer vigil, and which I thought was a horrible idea because I was really tired and wanted to go to sleep. But, you know, I went ahead and did it. And I couldn't understand why they would want to keep little kids up all night praying. So we all sat in this big room and we were all, you know, sitting on each other. You know, the little kids were sitting on our laps and things. And then suddenly I could hear outside shooting and explosions going on. And I realized that we were really right in the middle of the war. I mean, the fighting was going on all around us. And that's why we were having these vigils, because at night they were fighting, and it was really terrifying, the little kids who these little kids had been in these villages that had been destroyed by the fighting. And there were these, you know, children who hadn't been killed and were brought to this orphanage. So, yeah, it was a very intense experience.
So was there ever a point where you just said, I think I'd rather go home?
You know, it never really occurred to me to give up and go home. There was one point when I called my grandmother, Colette. It may have been her birthday or something. I love my grandmother. So I called her and she said, oh, you know, you should just come home. And I remember it so well because I remember being struck like, what? I could go home? Like, it hadn't even crossed my mind that I could do that. But no, I mean, there was no way I was going to leave George. I was totally in love with him. And as long as he was going to be there, I was going to be there with him. But we did, you know, finally we just were running out of money, and we had to turn around and come home.
In the end, do you think that revolution and all the internacionalistas who flocked to those countries, do you think you guys did some good?
The only thing that I think that maybe we contributed to seriously in Nicaragua is that I think that we helped contribute to a sense of pride for them, that during that time we took them very seriously. And I think a lot of countries and a lot of small, poor countries in the world, you know, get ignored. And here were all of these people coming there and acting like they were really important, and they were. So I think that we really helped with that. And then it was very sad later when the revolution was over and everyone just left. I mean, of course, you know, there's a big tourist industry in Nicaragua now, but, you know, it's not the same. So I think that that's what we contributed. I think we contributed to a sense of pride for the Nicaraguan people.
Debolyn Unferth is the author of Revolution. She spoke with Enstrain Champs. To dig deeper into the books and music you've heard in this hour, stop by our website. It's ttbook.org. You can become a Facebook fan of To the Best of Our Knowledge there, too. Just follow the link. Coming up, artists respond to a world without walls in a year of revolution, 1989. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. '89 is the year that was famously described as the end of history by scholar Francis Fukuyama, a radical claim for a radical year, which witnessed the fall of the Berlin Wall, the rise of revolution across the Eastern Bloc countries, and the Tiananmen Square protest in China. The world changed in 1989, and popular music changed along with it. Joshua Clover is a poet and music critic. He's the author of the book 1989, Bob Dylan Didn't Have This to Sing About. Steve Paulson asked him where the subtitle of the book came from.
The title or the subtitle of the book comes from a Jesus Jones song. I think the song that's probably most indexed to the fall of the wall in the Anglophone pop sphere, which is the song Right Here, Right Now, which has, among other things, the line Bob Dylan didn't have this to sing about.
Meaning that history has moved on since Dylan's heyday?
History has moved on, but also sort of come to a head. I mean, the more famous line from the song is right here, right now, watching the world wake up from history.
A woman on the radio talks about revolution when it's already passed her by. Bob Dylan didn't have this to sing about. You know it feels good to be alive. I was alive and I waited, waited. I was alive and I waited for this. Right here, right now. There is no other place I wanna be. Right here, right now. Watching the world wake up from history.
The point is that Dylan, I think it's a somewhat scoffing, which is sort of ballsy, a sort of scoffing idea that Dylan made a big political foo-for-ah when really there wasn't that much politically at stake if you compare it to the moment of 1989 when we're actually seeing real revolution after revolution, governments falling, the entire 20th century history of communism falling into collapse and disarray. But that was a real political moment. The times were really a change in Dylan's terms. Whereas when Dylan was singing, yeah, there was some social unrest, but basically
there was the Vietnam War going on.
There was indeed.
And a few other things, too.
Oh, I myself wouldn't take away from the historical significance of the 60s, although I can certainly understand the antagonism that follows the boomer generation and its sort of attempt to corner the market on political relevance. I certainly understand the resistance around that. But the Jesus Jones moment is, their claim is essentially apolitical. It's sort of like, this is an amazing geopolitical historical moment, and I want to soak it in and really feel its texture more than offer my analysis or my political program for it.
Well, let's talk about what happened in 1989. There were two huge world events. The Berlin Wall fell, essentially the end of the Cold War. And on the other side of the world, in China, the massacre at Tiananmen Square, it's sort of the opposite thing that would happen in the communist world. And you're making the argument that these events or this moment in time had a big impact on musicians.
The first thing I should say, if I can be allowed a two-part answer, is that one thing I'm really interested in is the way that they weren't moments. And we talk about them as moments now. They've really been reduced to those frozen images, the famous image from Tiananmen Square, in which the person who's almost universally known as Tank Man, according to Time Magazine's naming of him, standing in front of that line of tanks in Tiananmen Square, sort of standing it down. Just a single instant image a somewhat deceptive or disingenuous image, actually. And then the image of the wall being breached, you know, someone with a pickaxe and a moment. And what's interesting is how much we lose the fact that these were parts of long historical processes. If we think about Tiananmen Square, that moment had been brewing at least since they decided to move toward sort of a market economy with Chinese characteristics in 1978, 1979. But we lose this whole historical span, all these changes, all these debates, all these dynamics, and it just sort of becomes an instant. Now, I do think music tries to register that, and music is, of course, very good at capturing the instant. That's often what it's about, the very short song that's just sort of like, how it feels. So music played a role in compressing these complicated historical sequences or dynamics into moments. That said, it does seem clear to me that the way music changed around that time in 1989, and it changed markedly, extraordinarily, was, I think, very tied in to those changes that were happening politically. And that's the argument of the book. Or that's
give me some examples of that. I mean, I know you've written a whole book on this, but how did music change around 1989?
Well, the birth of grunge, the first Nirvana album, and of course dating the birth of things is always a little tenuous. But it's really, I think, the birth of grunge, which will turn out to be more or less the last big thing in the history of rock and roll proper. It's the birth of acid house or rave culture, which is, of course, a huge social phenomenon in the UK, doesn't really translate to the US entirely. And in the US, it's the shift in the history of hip-hop, which is on its way to becoming the utterly dominant global form of music, from a mode which was essentially identified with black identity, black power, black nationalism, Public Enemy being the most famous example, to the mode that would get called gangster rap, identified with N.W.A. and Dr. Dre. And that happens right in 1989, which starts with Public Enemy as the dominant hip-hop act in the country. And by the end of the year, N.W.A. is at the top of the charts, and this absolute historical change has happened. So those are different changes, and my account is that each in their own way contrives to sort of banish the mode of intergroup conflict. So in hip-hop, we see a shift from class analysis and race analysis, sort of black on white or rich and poor, to what gets called by conservatives black on black violence. It's internal to the community.
That's the way it goes in the city of Compton, boy, boy.
Acid House is all about peace, love, unity, respect, PLUR, their famous acronym, so it's very anti-antagonistic. And then grunge is sort of the return of punk. It was famously called, you know, there's that movie Grunge, 1991, the year punk broke. But it's punk without its social antagonism, without its quite well-known, especially British punk's class fury. It's all internalized and sort of psychologized. So it turns away from this struggle between groups, and it turns inward. And so I think that unites all these things is this abandonment, this vanishing of intergroup conflict.
Give me some concrete examples here. Rave music. What's an example of this shift you're describing?
Well, rave is a very, I think, nuanced case in that rave never had a moment of antagonism in it the way that, say, grunge with its punk history or hip-hop with its black nationalist history did. But it was interested, I think, in exploring this new world, a world that's obviously defined by the sudden disappearance of boundaries. That's the figure of the Berlin Wall, right? There's a wall. It's down. Now we have a supposedly boundaryless world. How do we feel that? So I think lots of rave songs start pursuing the emotional texture of this world in which nothing can ever come to a halt. So I think, for example, of the massive, what's sometimes called stadium rave of a band called the KLF that will be well known to some listeners and a cipher to many others, but I think is probably the great British band of the era. So they have a song called 3 a.m. Eternal. I think 3 a.m. Eternal is probably their greatest song. And even in the title, we can see it's somehow about this time that's at once late but can never come to an end. It's eternal. And that, I mean, very neatly matches up with Francis Fukuyama's famous, absurd but not empty claim that history had come to an end in 1989. Right?
And of course, he was making the claim that with the crumbling of communism, liberal democracy had triumphed once and for all. I mean, basically, the values of Western Europe and specifically of the United States had triumphed.
That's right. That's certainly his claim. So he was proposing a world which was now essentially a steady state. It was never going to change. We were pretty much in this liberal democratic capitalist life world, and it was going to go on forever.
You also write in your book about even more popular music. I mean, we've been talking so far about, you know, grunge and hip-hop and, you know, some of these particular genres. You also write about music that would seem to be totally apolitical. I mean, the stuff that just, you know, climbed the charts. What do you see as the cultural significance of what was happening in that kind of pop music?
It replicates the themes we've seen in some of the other genres, the attempt to explore timelessness. We start seeing very long, high-charting pop singles then. Historically, it's very hard to have a number one song that's longer than 4 or 4.5 minutes. There have been a couple exceptions, but historically it's very hard. What's interesting to me is around this time, right, in 1989, 1990, you start seeing considerably longer pop songs that really seem filled with surplus in that sense, that there could just be an infinite number of hooks and it could go on forever. So again, it's that sense of sustain. So I think of Like a Prayer by Madonna, a great song and a very elaborate song with many, many parts snapped together. And then the next year, Freedom 90 by George Michael, which, I mean, good Lord, it's called Freedom 90. And it's 6.5 minutes long, and it has about 8 different hooks in it, and it goes on and on. It's this sense like the world is ours, and we can go on forever, and every bit of glittering riches in it we can gather in. And how does that feel? How can we try and experience how that feels to live in that world? And for me, that's what those songs are about.
Joshua Clover is a journalist, music critic, and poet at the University of California, Davis. He's the author of 1989, Bob Dylan Didn't Have This to Sing About. He spoke with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to hear this program again, or check an author's name, or find out about a piece of music we used, visit our website, ttbook.org. To buy a copy of the program, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 116B, Singing the Revolution. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Veronica Rickard, with help from Ann Strainchamps, Doug Gordon, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. And you can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org. You'll also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.